And now we're going to AM New York Metro sports editor Joe Pantorno. Joe, over the weekend we got a sign of life from Governor Andrew Cuomo at the prospect of sports coming back. What's your take on this?
Hey, Alex, thanks so much for having me on. And yeah, we got a sign of life, a possible light at the end of this dark abyss of a tunnel that we've been dealing with for the past month, if you're a sports fan. And before I get into it, I just want to stress and preface this with, you know, how trivial this is compared to the grand scheme of things. And obviously, priority number one is to make sure that we are healthy and able to move forward as a society safely. But Governor Cuomo over the weekend kind of hinted that he wants sports to come back. He wants to find a way to get games back in New York, which is quite the undertaking considering that the state, and particularly New York City, is a hot spot within the epicenter of the outbreak. But he said he's been in touch with team owners over the past few days and kind of just said that the ball's in their court. Get creative, find a way to get sports back here, even if that means no fans involved, because let's be honest, that's really the only way that sports could return to New York, and at least give residents here a glimmer of hope or something to keep their minds off it. And that's what really sports is. It's that great equalizer that is able to kind of give us an avenue to blow off steam in a way where, you know, times right now are so ridiculously difficult and unprecedented, and we're kind of battening down the hatches here, and, you know, everybody's going through something. And, you know, for a couple hours a day, if people can turn on a ball game or, you know, watch a shortened NBA or NHL playoffs, that would do wonders just for the psyche of everyone moving forward.
Like you said, in comparison to the greater scheme of things going on with coronavirus, quarantine, and so much more, yeah, sports is trivial, but also in a way, it's not. It is, as you're saying, it's this escape that people need, especially people who are on the front lines. And I'm going to go to a moment after September 11th that I know you're so familiar with. And out of context, yes, it appears trivial, but within the context, it is something that intrinsically unifies us. And that's the Mike Piazza home run.
Yeah, and it's a moment that really he has carried with him throughout the end of his playing career and into the Hall of Fame. It's even on his Hall of Fame plaque. It's one of the largest moments in his career, and really it's one of the largest moments in baseball history, which at the end of the day, this is just a regular season game on September 21st, 2001, but just that moment to help kind of spur on the recovery process where really, you know, and I have difficulty speaking on this because I was only 9 at the time, so I kind of lacked the mental brevity to properly kind of absorb everything that was happening at that time. You obviously knew it was bad, but, you know, you were a kid. And really for a lot of kids my age there, those 90s kids, a lot of us were forced to grow up that day. But at the same time, we really couldn't fully comprehend it until years later. But really at a time where, you know, I think a lot of Americans thought they wouldn't see the light of day again just after the tragedies that happened. It was something, like I said before, trivial, like a baseball game, that kind of reached an arm down and took us by the scruff of the neck and started to pull us out. And obviously, it's hard to put sports at the same level of what actual real heroes do, whether that is our first responders, our troops, our medical professionals, but, you know, something that can collectively take society and lift it up the way a home run in a late September game could do. You know, it is heroic at the end of the day. So it's you know, we're all kind of hoping that that moment can come. And really, you saw just how important a NFL draft from Roger Goodell's basement was, just to say, hey, you know what? There's a live sporting event going on. Hey, you know what? Instead of me watching the news for, you know, 6-7 hours a day, I can turn on ESPN and I can forget about it. And, you know, I can get angry at who the Giants picked or who the Jets picked or why the Eagles took a quarterback in the second round or why the Packers took a quarterback in the first round. It's all stuff like that where we don't have to obsess about what might be, and we can just kind of enjoy what we have. And it's not much right now, but it's a nice reminder that, hey, you know what? Through all this, we're still here. We're still fighting. We're still kicking. You know, let's watch a ball game.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what you're saying about this. And to go back to the Mike Piazza home run, in my opinion, and I was even younger than you. I was only 5 at the time, and my dad was down at the tower that day. So, again, I couldn't comprehend any of this. But to me, in retrospect, because I watch this clip every single year, that was the first time New York cheered since everything happened. And whether it be Aaron Judge or who knows, someone on the Rangers or the Islanders, if hockey ends up coming back first or whatever, New York needs that moment of unity. And Yankees fans love the moment with Piazza. Just as in that season, Mets fans and the rest of the world was rooting for the Yankees in the World Series. It's so beautiful that sports, even though so many people in New York stand on different sides, we have common ground. If the Mets are to make a phenomenal run in a half season, the Yankees fans are going to pull for them, or vice versa. Islanders fans might even be rooting for the Rangers. That might be a little extreme. I don't know. We need to go over the official numbers and unemployment and everything to see if Islanders fans are root for the Rangers. But still, it's that common unity. And also something that I've been thinking about, I have a very good friend of mine who is a nurse working on the front lines of coronavirus, and he has a huge New York Rangers tattoo on him. And you have to remember that for the first responders, there's almost an obligation, just as the Blue Angels are going to be doing a flyover to support them. You got to remember how many of these people love sports and how much of their life is just dedicated to saving lives. You know, for someone coming off their third night in the ER, to be able to watch a game, to be able to have their own cheering moment, there's almost an obligation to them too to figure out a way to do this as almost tribute to what, as you said, the real heroes are doing.
Exactly. And I think we can see at least our politicians are starting to come to terms with such a fact. You know, Mayor de Blasio last week said that there would be a ticker tape parade for, you know, for our medical professionals and our first responders. And now Cuomo coming out and saying, hey, you know what? We're seriously looking at finding ways to reopen New York and trying to get back on our feet. And obviously, for the governor to talk about sports in such a high regard, he knows the impact that it has. So really, as long as this message is properly delivered to these athletes who I guess they're going to be apprehensive, of course, to come back and play in times like this. And really, they are going to be putting their bodies on the line in a completely different way this time. Because, again, coronavirus is not going to be eliminated. It's not just going to be eradicated from the face of the planet. And we know that it's going to be here for a while, and it's going to be here without a vaccine. And while these leagues are trying to come up with scenarios that will basically have these players in isolation, there's a risk that comes with it. But if that message of what they can do for a country that's really struggling right now and for people who daily are putting their lives and the health of their families on the line in the process, if they know what they can do for them, I think there's going to be a lot of players that soften on the stance and would be a little more willing to, you know, take the chance and try and get back on the field or on the ice or on the court. So really it's a message that can't be lost right now. And as soon as we can fully comprehend what the meaning of sports is, to a lot of people, you know, we'll kind of be stuck in this limbo right now of will they or won't they. But I think the governor is starting to hit the right notes here on really identifying how much this means to a lot of people.
So say, hopefully and ideally, there is a way within the next 2 months to have some return to sports. How do you think that that's going to go, and what sport do you think would return first in New York?
Yeah, so it's difficult to say right now just because there's a lot of different options flying around here. And for the way for sports to return, the most likely scenario right now is kind of what I touched on before, is that it would be at a neutral site where these teams are centrally located and in lowly affected areas. So obviously these leagues are cutting down the risk of somebody catching something, putting that risk down as low as possible. In terms of seeing the sport to come back first in New York, I personally think that it's not going to be one of the big four, whether that's baseball, football, hockey, or basketball. I think in New York you're going to see golf come back first, or horse racing especially, because they've been kind of in talks about getting going. And those are two sports that can come back and really not be as affected as others when it comes to not having any crowds or something like that. We know the U.S. Open, and this is golf I'm talking about, is going to be out in Mamaroneck, which is in New York, later this year. There's still no official word on U.S. Open tennis. We might have that coming back, especially now that the numbers are at least slowing down here in New York, the coronavirus numbers, that is. It's at least slowing down, and we're kind of flirting with, you know, an actual drop in numbers. I don't want to jinx anything because I guess that's how I am when it comes to superstition, but really I think we'll have those come back first, just because these are singular events or singular organizations, where in terms of our big professional teams, the Mets and the Yankees and the Knicks and the Nets and the Islanders and the Rangers, they can't really afford to have everybody coming into New York. The travel alone, I think, just to get teams to come here would scare a lot of people, I think, from, you know, taking the chance and getting back into action. So really, I think the centrally located idea, neutral sites, whether that's one location or the NHL might have four or five locations, for example, that's going to be probably the best option moving forward. And, you know, hopefully next year we can see, you know, sports back in New York with fans. I'd like to hope that sometime towards the end of this year, in October or November, we could see fans coming back to watch, you know, watch a baseball game. But honestly, there really hasn't been enough progress in terms of slowing this thing down or finding a way to stymie the spread that I think anybody would feel comfortable going out there. So it's going to be tough, and it's going to change on basically a daily basis. So hopefully something can be found out sooner rather than later.
It does seem like we're kind of in this thing for the long haul, unfortunately. And that's why just being able to even watch something, like you said, I have to double check this, but I believe the virtual NFL draft, at least the first round of it, had more viewers than game one of the World Series. That's how much it means right now.
Yeah. Yeah, the ratings were huge. Even rounds like 4 through 7, I think I read I saw a 32% increase in viewership compared to last year. That's enormous. And, you know, really, when there's really nothing else on, You know, it's the results are huge. So, you know, we've been kind of seeing it the last couple of days, even with the ESPN's Last Dance documentary on the 98 Chicago Bulls. I mean, that is must-watch TV right now, where, you know, I think the reception would have been huge, but probably a little more muted when, you know, everybody has other options or of things to watch. So, really, it suggests that if sports can come back, even in neutral sites, TV ratings are going to be through the roof. And I think that's going to be a saving grace for a lot of these commissioners.
Of course, and another big popular event that just happened, another draft, the WNBA draft, that gained so much traction. I saw so many things just trending on Twitter, and people were getting excited about this, as they should be. And I think, like you're saying, sports like tennis and golf are going to get a much better representation as the quote non-big four. And also something about tennis, I don't know if there will be a way to do this, but over the summer, there is a tennis league, and New York has a professional tennis team, the New York Empire. They play out of the Cary Leeds Center for Tennis and Learning up in the Bronx, a beautiful facility. It's like a U.S. Open Junior setting. And this is something Billie Jean King is heavily involved in, and I'm hoping, even if it isn't played in New York City, I'm hoping that there is a way for this tennis league to be able to go on this summer, even if it's in a domed bubble with a handheld camera setup. I think, because I had covered this last year, I had followed the New York Empire, who, as you and I have talked about before we started doing this podcast, they had an upset win last year that was equivalent to what the U.S. did to the Soviets in 1980 for hockey. And I think that this, if there won't be baseball, if there will be hockey, or maybe there won't be football, maybe in the fall, if there's not much on besides a documentary about Michael Jordan and drafts and golf, I think this is an opportunity for people to jump all in. I really do.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you here. And you might actually see some of these less popular leagues taking a little bit more of a risk just to get back, because we've seen with the few events that have happened over the past few weeks that if they're able to get going, if you're able to televise it and bring it to the homes of millions of sports fans, they're going to watch and they're going to talk about it. And like you said, if the WNBA draft, you know, if the WNBA can somehow get its season going, and, you know, Sabrina Ionescu can get out there for the New York Liberty, people are going to watch. You know, and she's being billed as the next big superstar in New York. So if, you know, the WNBA can somehow find a way to get back before, you know, some of the other major sports, you're going to see a lot of New Yorkers kind of perk up and take interest here. So there's opportunities to seize, I suppose. But again, you just have to do so in a safe manner, which is easier said than done. But, you know, at this point, it's something that a lot of these smaller leagues, even say the MLS, you know, might want to consider.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, soccer, you really have limited interaction with hand-to-hand contact, particularly with the ball and with other players. You have your goalkeepers, but even they're wearing huge pairs of gloves already. It doesn't seem too crazy. And if you go to a park, you'll see a lot of kids are volleying a soccer ball wearing masks. No one's using their hands. They're only using their feet. It's not too crazy to think that soccer or golf, which has a slated return in Mamaroneck, Westchester, and tennis too. You know, there's a way to do tennis where one player serves with their own set of balls, another player with theirs. No one touches what the other person had touched, if you think about it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are options to take, and really it's you know, I'm sure that the moment that all of these sporting events have been frozen, you know, the commissioners and the powers that be have been tirelessly finding ways to get back to action. And I think really they've just been kind of waiting for the green light. And, you know, I don't think that's really going to come yet. But Cuomo is at least kind of loosening the bolts on the floodgates. So who knows? Maybe we'll have good news in the near future. But, you know, I don't want to get anybody's hopes up, obviously. And you shouldn't get your hopes up either. I mean, basically anything that comes back within the next few months, just take it as a pleasant surprise, because, you know, really it's, you know, we're in uncharted territories here. So you can't really fault anybody or any of these decision makers for wanting to, you know, play it safe and make sure everybody's all right before, you know, letting sports come back. But again, it's a wait and see kind of mentality.
Of course. And like you're saying, I think the phrase better safe than sorry has new meaning coming out of this. And there is optimism in South Korea starting up. They start baseball next week, right?
Yes, they do. And it's the KBO. Their opening day is slated for May 5th. And obviously it's gotten the attention of the United States, and in particular ESPN, who's in negotiations with the league to air some of their games in the United States, which would obviously bring the 10-team league to completely new heights in terms of popularity. And it also gives American sports fans an opportunity to watch their game just on the other side of the world.
I think what it also does for American sports leagues, particularly the MLB, they get to witness a trial by fire and adapt and see how they can bring it back, see what the South Korean Baseball League does, see what works for them, what doesn't work. Okay, maybe we can't do that, but we can do this. So more than anything, it's exciting to see a dry run of a sport coming back.
Absolutely, and it's worth noting that it kind of has to be taken with a grain of salt, just because South Korea so effectively was able to enforce their social distancing and provide mass testing, which really can't be said for the United States. But we saw South Korea in early March as being one of the hotspots of COVID-19. And really, it's been about a month and a half. Those numbers have just plummeted, where since, I think it's been since April 8th, they haven't reported more than, I think it's like 39 positive cases daily, which is obviously a huge accomplishment. And, you know, I think we're in completely different places, but hope, you know, ideally, one day I would certainly like to hope that the United States could reach such low numbers. But I think they're in a much better place than the United States is right now. And, you know, they kind of have an easier time getting back. I mean, I don't think we'll see fans in attendance. I don't think that's the plan for now. But at the rate they're going, it's not out of the realm of possibility that you could see fans in attendance by the end of the season. They play 144 games a year. So, you know, who knows?
Well, it certainly sounds exciting. And maybe even baseball will, our baseball, that is, will take the hint to possibly shorten a season. That's a talk for another day. But like you said, take it with a grain of salt. But just, I feel like any news right now is almost good news or a good sign. One that isn't stolen by the Houston Astros. I'm sorry, I had to do that. But like you said, also going back with the Michael Jordan documentary, now is a time to appreciate what was in the past and to reflect on kind of the best of in a lot of ways. And I know that you're working on a very special best of project. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So basically what we're doing here at AM New York Metro is that we, with the help of our readers, we're going to try and put together Major League Baseball's all-time starting lineup. So basically, it'll be one player per position, putting together, you know, all of the eras, and trying to put together, I guess, the best team possible. So what we'll do is, starting tomorrow, every day we'll present a position to our readers, and I'm going to aggregate a list of 10 of the best players, I guess, that you can say have ever played at the position, and obviously that could fuel a debate within itself. But I've kind of created this algorithm, at least, to kind of hone down the list to just 10. I think because if we had more than that, the voting results would be so skewed in a way. So basically what we've been looking at is just traditional stats, which, you know, you look on any scorecard or box score or baseball stat line, you'll see hits, home runs, batting average, on-base percentage, OPS, things like that. That's what really kind of is the first thing we look at when interpreting whether a player is good or great or elite or Hall of Famer, however you'd like to call it. But then we also look at wins above replacement, which is a kind of an advanced stat that has been kind of controversial, I guess, in the baseball community. Some people live and die by the stat. Other people really don't like it. Really, that is a statistic estimating just how many wins a player can bring to his team and how many, I guess, wins a team would lose with him out of the lineup. And it's been, it's kind of allowed us to quantify just how valuable players are, not so much today, but particularly in the past when we try and kind of explain the worth of some of these Hall of Famers. Well, yeah, you know, Babe Ruth revolutionized baseball and he was the game's first real power hitter and brought the popularity of the game to such a new level, but
can he get on base?
How valuable was he to his team? So WAR kind of helps decipher that, and it allows us to properly or try to properly compare him to, say, somebody like Mike Trout today. So then obviously we'll look at that too. We look at if a player was able to win or help his team achieve success. I think that's going to be coming up in our catcher debate, because really, if you kind of look at the stats, you can say, well, on one hand, Mike Piazza is the greatest offensive catcher of all time. But on the other hand, there's really been no other catcher that's won as much as Yogi Berra, who's considered, again, one of the best. So, you know, these are the kind of debates that'll help bring it all together. And then finally, we'll kind of take into consideration the eras in which they played in. Not so much as saying that, say, a player like Babe Ruth is at a disadvantage because he played in an earlier time, but there are certain factors that each player in each era had to contend with. So if you're looking at a player like Ty Cobb, who was, you know, the early 1900s greatest hitter, he had to deal with outlawed pitches. You know, he was, during his prime, it was in the dead ball era, where he had to face pitchers that regularly threw the spitball. And conditions were extremely bad for hitters. And, you know, baseballs themselves weren't switched out after every pitch or every at-bat. So you're playing a full game with one ball. So you're trying to track a baseball that's, you know, brown or even black coming out of the pitcher's hands. And, you know, all these things kind of add up. And if you go across the eras, you'll find each time period kind of had its own challenge, whether pitcher's mounds were raised or even coming into today, just the advancements in technology and training and conditioning, how players are just so much stronger and kind of more well-conditioned for this, where it's a year-round job. It's you know, baseball is now a science. So, you know, we can say that the game itself as a whole is more difficult today. So, again, these are all things that we try and piece together to properly compare players from different eras. So hopefully you'll be able to make the most informed decision when you're voting between somebody like a Christy Mathewson or a Sandy Koufax, something like that. So, yeah, this will be a nice, fun project. Hopefully it takes our minds off of what's going on in the outside world, even if it's for a few minutes. And hopefully our readers can get involved and really enjoy it. So they'll have an opportunity to vote, and you know, they'll be able to do so basically after we release the article. They can vote on our social media pages, or they can come and find me on Twitter or via email, and they can tell me who they want. We'll keep track, and we'll hopefully build something fun here.
And Joe, another point about just the different eras and almost the different dimensions of baseball, the literal different dimensions of baseball. When you look at a field like the Polo Grounds or even Ebbets Field, 250 feet will get you a home run in right field, but, you know, 500 feet down center field and Willie Mays makes the catch.
Right, and I think that's what was the beautiful thing about baseball back then. Those old stadiums, they really had to adapt to their surroundings. And, you know, a big reason why, say, the Green Monster at Fenway Park was built is because they had to find a way to fit a stadium into these confined spaces where, okay, you know, down the left field line, it's 320 feet. Well, how can we combat that to make sure that every pop-up down the left field line isn't a home run? Oh, well, we'll build the wall 37 feet high or however high it is. So really, each of those old-school ballparks kind of absorbed the community around it, and those dimensions had to be tweaked just for the stadium to fit. And I think that, you know, I think obviously that's what's lost today, and really in the 70s and the 80s, they kind of came out with these cookie-cutter stadiums where the dimensions are, you know, pretty similar, not entirely similar, but, you know, that's what was so special about those old stadiums and what kind of gave each city's ballpark its charm. And that's why, you know, a place like Wrigley Field and a place like Fenway Park, that's why they're so revered nowadays, because it's that link to the past. And, you know, it kind of helps explain or it helps fans take a look back as to why baseball is the way it is, why dimensions aren't uniform today. So it's that fun kind of stuff where, you know, we can kind of look back and, you know, learn something new, I guess.
The way that I look at a stadium's dimensions is similar to a city skyline. Everyone is meant to be different. When you go to Boston, you're supposed to know, wow, if you not even dealing with the Green Monster, but you can hit like a 250-foot ground rule double down the right field line. And I saw Andrew Benintendi do that in person, actually, and I was baffled by it. Or if you go to Chicago, you have the Ivy, you have this, you have that. You can watch a game from a literal rooftop at Wrigley Field. And, of course, the iconic facade at Yankee Stadium, the short porch in right field, as it's been called. You know, that's part of it. Just as, like I said, every time you go to a city, you see buildings created, built, developed differently for that specific purpose. You want to know you're in Chicago when you see the Willis Tower. You want to know you're in New York when you see the Empire State Building or the World Trade Center. So that makes it so exciting. And I think what you're doing here with this is really cool because it puts it in perspective. And just like you, I'm a history nerd. I love learning more about the history of the game. And who are some other New York ball players that are going to be up for mention?
Okay. Well, you know, New York has been blessed to have really four big major league teams play in the city over the past 100 plus years. Obviously, before the Mets, there were the Giants and Dodgers that were playing in New York, and obviously with the Yankees. So there's options abound. And so I guess just on a short list, we'll go, you know, I'll just list a couple that I can off the top of my head. You'll obviously see Tom Seaver from the Mets and Mike Piazza from the Mets. From the Yankees, obviously laden with big guns, you'll have Babe Ruth, you'll have Lou Gehrig, you'll have Mickey Mantle, you'll have Joe DiMaggio, you'll have Berra, you'll have Dickey. And then from the Brooklyn Dodgers, you'll see Roy Campanella in the catcher conversation. Depending on how things work out, you could see Jackie Robinson in the second base conversation. Pee Wee Reese in the shortstop conversation. And then for the Giants, they're obviously headlined by Willie Mays. And again, once I completely run the numbers, but obviously dark horse candidates that you could possibly see on the ballot. Melott, you might see. Christy Mathewson, obviously, is going to be in the pitching conversation. He was one of the premier pitchers in the early 1900s and 1910s. So those are, at least off the top of my head, who you could see. So there'll be a lot of local pride, I guess, and hopefully that doesn't skew the decision makers, but we all know that nostalgia is one hell of a drug, and team loyalty is something on a completely different level than that. So I will ask that everybody tries to be as objective as possible. Obviously a big ask, but at the end of the day, I just want everybody to have fun with it.
Of course, and it is something to be fun. And you know, to the Yankees and the Mets credit, because the Mets two championship teams were nothing to scoff at. And compared to other championship teams, they would totally go the distance. But you got to remember, the Yankees managed to put like some of the best on the field together consistently. So that local pride might even add up to the facts. And of course, there's plenty of other talent, plenty of other unsung, overwhelmingly superstar players that may have not had the particular success of Derek Jeter, but they're talented nonetheless.
Exactly. And yes, Jeter's obviously going to be on that list at shortstop, and I apologize for overlooking him in this initial conversation. But, you know, and I do want to kind of talk about Jeter, because if you go and speak to a lot of baseball fans, especially those who are around our age, they will tell you that Derek Jeter is the greatest shortstop of all time. And I'm not sure. Actually, I'm curious to hear what you would think about this too. You know, if you were to pick the greatest shortstop of all time, where would you have Derek Jeter?
That's tough.
Right.
He's the greatest of an era, and that's yes. Where I think we're going to have fun with this.
Exactly. So for me, you know, my personal opinion, and again, I won't say, I'll try not to say it out loud, but to me, Derek Jeter is not number one. And I have somebody completely different at number one who played their baseball 120 years ago. So really, it's that kind of debate here. That's what I'm looking for. You know, something where I'm not going to call it a hot take, but you know, kind of a well-researched proposal here that can say, hey, you know what, you might have grown up thinking that you know, Babe Ruth is the greatest right fielder ever. Well, you know what, why don't we take a look at Ted Williams's stats? Or hey, you know, I know you think that Ernie Banks might be the greatest second baseman ever. Well, you know what? Why don't I show you Rogers Hornsby's stats? Stuff like that. And that's really kind of all I want to do. Really, the purpose of this is to educate baseball fans and provide an outlet of sorts so they can take their mind off things for a while.
It certainly sounds like a great way to do it, not just in the sense of putting together what is a dream team for Major League Baseball, but it's very thought-provoking as to what greatness means now, what greatness meant then, and I really think a lot of people are going to brush up on their baseball history, and when you brush up on baseball history, you really brush up on the nation's history in a lot of ways. It's inadvertent, and I find that so exciting. Now, another thing that I'm thinking about, how do you measure the greatest managers?
Yeah, see, that's a completely different ball game, because obviously there aren't many stats to quantify the worth of a manager per se. But when you think about the game's greatest managers, you obviously think about winning. You know, it's pretty self-explanatory and pretty straightforward. But also I think that there are managers who revolutionize the game, and there are managers that kind of help shape the game. And when you have a conversation about the most, you know, the greatest managers per se, you know, a few names obviously pop into your mind. And, you know, in terms of, you know, you'll think of Joe Torre and you'll think of Tony La Russa. You might even think of Bobby Cox or, you know, Earl Weaver, Sparky Anderson. You know, you take a look back to, again, say a guy like Connie Mack, who managed the Athletics for, you know, 40 years or 50 years. You know, you look at a guy like John McGraw, who, you know, coached the Giants for 30 years and won a, you know, a number of championships. And you look at a guy like Casey Stengel, who was the leader of those Yankees dynasty teams in the 40s and 50s. So, you know, I think it's a lot tougher to try and come up with a bona fide greatest manager of all time in a way, just because there are so many that there are so many that, you know, did so much for the game, and they accrued so much. And I can't have an answer for you, and I don't think I'll really ever have an answer for you. And really, you want to talk about an endless debate? That's one for another day for sure.
Yeah, you're. I think you hit the nail on the head with that.
So I mean, but that's the fun thing, and that's really what makes baseball so special to a lot of us. Is you know, I can connect the game to the game that my father watched, and he can connect the game that he watched to his father, and, you know, my grandpa with his father before that. So, you know, the fact that baseball has remained relatively unchanged for so long is what allows us to really appreciate it as much as we do, and it allows us to have these conversations. So, you know, And I'm going to kind of paraphrase historian George Early a little bit here. When, you know, archaeologists 2,000 years from now do their research and dig up what was the United States, they're going to find that its three greatest contributions were the Constitution, jazz music, and baseball. And I think that's exactly what it should be.
I can get behind that. I really can. I might throw a modern adaptation to pizza on there, among a few other things. But yeah, those are the three bases, and I guess pizza is the home plate. But
I like it,
Joe. That sounds awesome. And on the topic of managers, to spoil my hypothetical vote, I would probably go for Casey Stengel, because you'll likely have him managing some of his own on this all-time roster. This is awesome. I cannot wait to get involved in it myself. And once again, Joe, thank you for coming on. Hopefully there's some good news in the future as far as the fate of sports. But until then, we have stuff to look forward to, even if it's our own retrospective view of things. In the future, we're going to have a fun little discussion about sports movies and which are the most iconic for each sport and just which ones are great. I mean, so many of them are great, but to kind of go head-to-head with them, I know we have alternating views and I have a bit of a controversial take, but I'm going to keep that in the bank for now. I'm definitely going to have you back on soon. Joe, thank you. Let's hope for some good news.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Looking forward to it.
All right, take care.
You too.